You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie, and I'm joined in the studio for Solidarity Breakfast on this fine, incredibly fine Saturday morning with Anila. G'day, Anila.
Hi, Annie.
And Tabea.
Good morning.
Yes, come on, beat it.
It is a good morning. No, it is a good morning.
I've never heard you speak so enthusiastically about anything than the weather, Annie, and every single week makes me happy.
Because the pollen count's low.
Yeah, yeah. But also because I'm a bike rider. You know what it told us? I look it up and it said, wear your raincoat, but there was not one spot of rain on my way here. So, you know, so much for bomb.
$96 million website and all.
It was so lovely. I even managed to work. This is a bit TMI. Worked up a bit of a sweat. Speed walking to the bus stop.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, if you aren't out of bed yet, you'll find that it's a lovely day outside there. And we've got a whole... And also, you've got to admit that when it's a lovely day, it's a tonic against some of the depressing news. And one of the part of the depressing news that's been happening is that the passage of the Allan government's new laws to sentence children as adults, exposing them to possible life imprisonment for some crimes, marks a tragic turning point for all Victorians. This is the Justice Reform Initiative that I'm quoting, but I feel the same. And it was passed in the final sitting day of the year. The Parliament heard opposition from a number of MPs who shared the widespread view of experts and sector voices that these laws will fail to reduce crime, will fail to improve community safety, and will cause enormous harm to Victorian children, families and communities.
And I think, you know, important to mention, completely undermining Australia's commitment to kind of human rights, legal infrastructure internationally and domestically. I came across a quote from Sue Ann Hunter, who's the National Commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People. And she had to say, these new laws violate Australia's obligations under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which state that detention as punishment should only be used as a last resort and for the shortest period possible. She went on to say, treating 14-year-olds as adults in criminal proceedings, removing the principle of detention as a last resort and imposing potential life sentences directly contravenes these obligations and removes the human rights protections that are meant to protect our most vulnerable.
It's that one thing about having, you know, you got treaty in one hand, but then you got passing legislation that's going to massively negatively impact First Nations communities.
It's a real suits approach, isn't it? We've got it all in order. There's nothing to look at. We're all in suits. We're talking in calm and rational voices.
And well, you're entrenching criminalisation and poverty for a generation of children. Is not taking your commitment to closing the gap seriously.
Yeah, that coupled with the propaganda operation that they did on Channel 7 where they showed, you know, the top secret Victoria Police Judge Dredd station on Spencer Street, and they show behind the scenes how they can tactically coordinate everything and just how many cameras they got and how many eyes they got all over the city, with Nick Reese wanting to also give them 1,000 more eyes on the streets with his Safe Cities smart cameras program.
Well, you know, Dick Reese is in the eye of the storm at the moment, because apparently he ran on a ticket that he wasn't going to take any money from developers. But apparently the Mariner Group has now been allowed to build some enormous tower in the CBD, which is causing locals to be really, really a little bit upset. And the other thing about this, about the Thousand Eyes that you're putting forward, is that because of the mainstream media's love affair with power, they're placing the point of view as if we, us ordinary people walking down the street, think this is a great thing. Actually, these are the overlords who are telling us that they can push us around. So basically, the point of view of the mainstream media is not the normal person anymore. It's not mainstream. It's not the main street. People pretending that they're all on our side is just a crock. It's a crock.
Well, I mean, on the changing role of the media, the new appointment for acting chair of SBS, our public broadcaster, is one Christine Zeitz, who has, by her record, over 35 years of global experience in strategy, revenue and profitability growth, business turnarounds, mergers, acquisitions, e-commerce, marketing and building functional and cohesive teams. You'll know her from holding roles such as CEO of Northrop Grumman Australia, a weapons company, CEO of Leidos Australia, a company that specializes in building sovereign capability, university alliance for that one beautiful thing called maritime autonomy, air and missile defense, and intelligence solutions. But not only that, she's been the CEO or the vice president and managing director of Lockheed Martin for Australia and the Asia Pacific, and the president of Northeast Asia of BAE Systems.
Oh, it sounds perfect for the SBS.
Yeah.
Just perfect, man. Perfect.
Pity they didn't put it in yellow subtitle font, her CEO resume.
It sort of requires us to move across to the US and the US lies. For us in Australia, they've just signed a new AUKUS something or other, I don't know, where we give them more money and we do what we're told sort of thing. And at the same time, the Secretary of Defence, he's been called, Peter Hegseth in America.
Yeah, whose title is actually on his little placard in the Oval Office is the Secretary of War.
Yeah, yeah. And you were noticing something else about that presentation.
Oh, yeah, if you look on the ABC coverage, where they still erroneously refer to him as the Secretary of Defence, even though the placard says Secretary of War, they actually have put an extra S, so... Not sure if that's a dog whistle or that's maybe them just letting it slip, the SS.
And the reason why we bring it up is that there was a report in The Intercept about how the Secretary of War, Peter Hegseth, is under increasing fire, and this is unbelievable language, fire for a double tap strike, first reported by The Intercept in early September, in which the US military killed two survivors of the Trump administration's initial boat strike in the Caribbean on September the 2nd. They call it a double tap strike, where they actually go in to kill people who survived the original attack. Now, people who can't defend themselves.
And again, no evidence provided that these people have committed any sort of crime.
Yeah, the Washington Post recently reported that Hegseth personally ordered the follow-up attack, giving a spoken order to, this is inverted commas, to kill everybody. Multiple military legal experts, lawmakers, and now confidential sources within the government who spoke with The Intercept say Hegseth's actions could result in the entire chain of command being investigated for war crimes or outright murder.
And I think on that note as well, we've had another strike in the Pacific on an alleged, emphasis on the alleged, drug vessel, killing four people. Again, no evidence provided to establish that this boat has any relationship to carrying illicit narcotics. Since September 2nd, that's 87 people killed in more than 20 strikes in the Caribbean and Pacific.
And just to finish up, as we move into Voices for Palestine, on the American lies, Honduran opponents to former President Juan Orlando Hernandez protest outside the federal court in Manhattan on April the 22nd, 2022 in New York, because of the ex-Hernandez president President Juan Hernandez made his first appearance before a US judge. He has just been freed. Trump frees ex-president of Honduras, right-wing narco-dictator convicted of drug trafficking. Now, this is the appalling truth of the matter is Trump is just going, look at, we want Venezuela, and he accuses one head of state of being a narco-terrorist, in inverted commas, when he now allows his bosom buddy, quite clearly, a free ticket. So nothing that comes out of America can be trusted.
And we'll go now to a two-part Voices for Palestine. We'll hear first from the Electronic Intifada's Nora Barris-Friedman, who the Electronic Intifada have reached out and said that they're happy to go forward with a partnership with 3CR, which is incredibly exciting news for us because we love their reporting. And then we'll hear from a night of poems that Anilo recorded on the weekend.
Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. The Israeli army continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip in spite of the October 10th so-called ceasefire. Sniper fire, tank shelling, drone strikes, and aerial attacks are routine and incessant, especially in areas east of the vague and invisible yellow line demarcated by Israel. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on November 27th that in the areas beyond the so-called yellow line, which comprises more than 50% of the Gaza Strip, quote, daily detonations of residential buildings continue to be reported and access to humanitarian assets, public infrastructure, and agricultural land remains restricted or altogether barred. Access to the sea remains prohibited, the UN added. That footage is from Gaza-based journalist Abed Sabah with Dropsite News, showing the Israeli army's yellow concrete blocks that it moved 300 meters westwards into the Gaza City neighborhoods of Al-Tufah and Shujaya last month. The UN's Children's Fund, UNICEF, stated on November 21st that at least 67 children have been killed in Gaza since the ceasefire took effect, an average of nearly 2 children killed per day, and dozens more have been injured. On Wednesday, December 3rd, at least 5 Palestinians, including 2 children, were killed by an Israeli drone strike on tents housing displaced people in Al-Mawasi, west of Khan Yunus. This footage by Mahmoud Bassam shows tent shelters on fire as people rush to rescue those trapped in the flames. Also on Wednesday, the Wafa news agency reported that a Palestinian man was shot and killed by Israeli fire in the Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. Maha Husseini, journalist and researcher with Euromed Human Rights Monitor, stated on Wednesday that, quote, Israeli tanks have advanced into Gaza City, reaching the Shujaya roundabout in the east, just a short distance from the city center. This is around 700 meters west of the actual yellow line that was agreed on. Israel's yellow line shifts daily, swallowing more of Gaza's land and quietly forcing hundreds of families from their homes. Israel is exploiting the decline in media coverage of its genocide in Gaza, she said. Israeli army vehicles were reported opening fire in the eastern part of the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza on Tuesday, killing at least one person. On November 29th, an Israeli quadcopter drone targeted and killed 2 young boys, 9-year-old Fadi Abu Assi and his 10-year-old brother Juma Abu Assi, in the Bani Suhaila neighborhood of Khan Yunus. The boys were reportedly gathering firewood to sell in order to buy food as well as medical supplies for their disabled father. In a video report by journalists Doa Mohammed and Samar Al-Boji, the boy's father says they had eaten breakfast and gone into town to earn a few shekels before his checkup the next day when the drone targeted them. CNN said that he was, quote, waiting for them to return so he could set the table, when nearby residents rushed to his shelter saying 2 kids had been targeted and killed by Israeli troops. "Are they my children?" he recalled asking. An agonizing wait ensued as he went to identify the bodies. "I removed the shroud and hugged them. My little Juju's head was blown off. God rest his soul. His arms were severed and parts of his torso were gone," he said. "Fadi's right hand and left leg were cut off," he added, according to CNN. The Israeli army admitted it had carried out the strike, calling the small children, quote, "two suspects who crossed the yellow line, conducted suspicious activities on the ground, and approached IDF troops operating in the southern Gaza Strip, posing an immediate threat to them." Following the identification, the Israeli Air Force eliminated the suspects in order to remove the threat, the army said. In the week before, on November 22nd, Israel carried out a series of attacks across Gaza, killing more than 20 Palestinians. Footage from drop site News' Abed Sabah shows the aftermath of an Israeli strike on a busy Gaza City intersection that killed 5 people. The Israeli army also attacked homes and shelters in Deir al-Balah and Nuseirat in central Gaza. Reporter Musab al-Sharif filmed this clip of a residential building on fire after an Israeli airstrike on the Nasser neighborhood of Gaza City, which killed at least 4 Palestinians. On November 30th, the Gaza government media office stated that over the 50 days since the ceasefire came into effect, Israel has committed more than 590 separate violations, killed more than 350 Palestinians, and injured at least 900. The media office stated that these violations include 164 direct shooting incidents targeting civilians, homes, residential neighborhoods, and displaced persons' tents, 25 incursions by occupation vehicles into residential and agricultural areas crossing the temporary yellow line, 280 shelling and bombardment operations by land, air, and artillery, and 118 demolitions of homes and civilian infrastructure.
Israel's Our next reader is Michaela Sahar, who is an Australian-Palestinian writer and educator living on unceded Wurundjeri country. Her essays, poetry, and commentary have appeared in Cordite, Mianjin, Overland, Rabbit, and Sydney Review of Books, among others. She is a Wheeler Centre Next Chapter Fellow from 2021, a grant recipient from the Neilma Sydney Literary Travel Fund, and was commended for the Peter Blasey Fellowship in 2024. Find me at the Jaffar Gate, an encyclopedia of a Palestinian family, which is in Michaela's hands and is absolutely brilliant, is her first book. Please give Michaela a very rousing round of applause. Thank you so much for having me. I asked George on Friday if I'd been asked to read poetry or if anything would do. George said anything would do. And I thought about the fact that I don't write a lot of poetry these days, and in the last 2 years, since October 2023, I've written 2 poetic essays and 3 poems. And they're all really harrowing. They have titles like An Essay on Human Animals and On the Preservation of Violence. And I thought I'd read something a little bit more uplifting. So this is a story in my book, embedded in the book. It's in 2 or 3 different times. It's about the first time that I went to Palestine, and I actually got trapped in Amman because my luggage got lost, and I was staying with some friends, and my father was born in Amman, so I thought I would go and see where he was born. And it was as a result of that that I heard a story that I'd never heard before, and now you're going to hear that story too. No one expects my visit, least of all me, and Amro and Noor are not free the next day to show me Amman. But they give me their driver, a Palestinian man named Ali. I have not thought much about what to do in Amman, and when Ali arrives and asks me what I would like to see, I can think of only one thing, odd request for a tourist. But Ali fulfills it and places it first on our itinerary, a list which he adds to himself as we wind through the day. And we set out from the house on the hill to the Italian hospital in downtown Amman, located on a street that is eponymously titled Italian Hospital Street. It is perhaps from my mother I hear that my father has no copy of his birth certificate, though Dad later uncovers a fragile and heavily folded piece of paper stored in a small velvet pouch for jewellery and written in Arabic, which Dad cannot read, which he claims may or may not be that document. And I tell Ali, and he says, Khalas, we'll get him one, since my father is born in the year of the Nakba, here in Amman, at the hospital we are now visiting. Ali and I walk through the entrance and into an older wing, which looks like a wing that might have been there from the hospital's founding, or at least from the time when my father arrives 22 years later. We are looking for the hospital registry office, and we walk along corridors and up a flight of wide stairs, and there are pictures of earlier buildings and the Italian nuns, and Ali says to me, they're very nice people here, you know. When my wife had our children, they helped us, although we are Muslim and we had no money, but at the Italian hospital, they will help anyone. And he looks at me kindly, and I suppose he remembers the arrival of his own precious babies, and he steers me into the office, which is marked in Arabic as the office we need to be in. Inside, there are quite a few people waiting, stretched out on plastic chairs, and I can see that Ali feels important, guiding me to the registrar behind a built-in island in front of a door, beyond which must lie all the records, including the one I am looking for. Ali says, this woman is from Australia and she's here to collect a proof of birth certificate for her father. And the registrar is quite sympathetic and asks me the date, and I write it down in English and also Arabic. Scant things I can write in Arabic, but numbers are some of them. She looks at the date and then her eyes open wide. 48, she says, you should see the files from that year, it's a mess. It will take us some time to find this. Ali is undaunted. He gives them his number to call when they do, but I never have heard if they find this precious file of my father's arrival, or if Ali is called, or if someone, maybe Ali or Amro, has sent the paper on which it notates the birth of a baby who is now an old man, my dear dad, born in the year of our Nakba. Leaving the hospital, we look down to where Ali says you could once see the Jordan running through Amman, and at the bottom is Hashemi Street. That even this resolute geography of steep peaks and troughs is all redeveloped now. On Hashemi Street, Ellen and Pa and their children live in a house or a hut of one or two rooms, and it has a dirt floor, which is swept with such vigour that it is a firm and smooth surface where little eddies of dust are not permitted. At Hashemi Street, there is a toilet in an outhouse, and Vera, my aunt, says it is around this structure she acquires a scar on her face because they are playing a war game called Jews and Palestinians, and the older children lock her in, like is done to the Palestinians in Jerusalem, and she is distraught and comes to whatever grief is the grief that befalls her at 6 3/4 to leave her with this scar and lasting memory of Amman. In the dwelling at Hashemi Street, Vera would often say to Ellen, Mum, you should have let us jump on our furniture, because now the Jews have it, and they are probably jumping on it. And if that is not literally true, you will see that metaphorically Vera sees accurately into the substance of the politics she lives through, and which is now history. When my father is born, Abdullah and Ellen have 4 children already, and already a son, and it is upon this eldest son that their duty is discharged. As usual, they name the first son the name of his grandfather. So there is no great weight or moment attached to the naming of my father. Ellen and Abdullah invite a couple without children who live in a hut quite near them in Amman, Jerusalemite Armenians, who are also displaced in this year of our Nakba, to name the second son they give birth to. And this couple name my father for the name of the husband. No skipping of generations between names for the Armenians, and my dad is named Yusuf, and no one now remembers the name of the wife, because her name is not given to any of these children. I hear that they loved him, and after he is weaned, would often take him for feeding, an honour they arranged with a system of broken mirror pieces flashed up and down the hill, catching sun to attract one another's attention. On my phone, forgotten at Amrol's, I will later find two messages waiting, one from Juju, my aunt, and one from my uncle Tony, who is particularly enlivened by this trip, and who I do not recall contacting me until this day in October, when I am visiting his childhood. Juju and Tony both want me to know about the night which followed the birth of my father, these oldest children who remember his birth, and now it is only Juju who carries this with her. This is the story they tell me, and one I have told on the radio, and which I would tell you now too. And his siblings have teased my father all his life, calling him the Urduni. And when I finish my PhD, Irene gives me a kefir in red, the Jordanian colours, and they laugh again. And Dad says, Michaela knows who I am, which is Palestinian. When Ellen gives birth to my father, she is running a fever and suffering the hallucinations of delirium. Poor woman who has left her loved home in Jerusalem not a week earlier, a departure from Palestine, which is not the last one, but is in many ways final, precipitated quite specifically by this baby's arrival. So Ellen gives birth to the boy that my pa refers to also lovingly on the tape as Joey. And once he arrives, the Italian nuns say to her, shall we put your baby in the nursery to give you some rest? And Ellen, who I tell you is sick, fights vehemently to keep the new baby beside her before going to sleep. On January 16, Ellen wakes to the news that the nursery at the Italian hospital in Amman has burnt down. And she becomes quite hysterical until the baby is produced and placed in her arms. And they say, look, here he is. He has spent his first night beside you. And in hindsight, we see that the life of my father surely hinges on the capacity of Ellen to fight, not once, but twice for his life, which ensures my newborn father survives his first night on this earth and the many more nights that will follow after that first one is over. Thank you.
Thank you.
running along the beach with my head flowing back. What's that? What was that?
There's a man in my head listening to that. We've got a man with a really luscious mustache running towards a woman in a bathing suit.
They do have really luscious mustaches. That's 70s Palestinian rock band, one of the first rock bands in Palestine called The Blooms, Al-Barim.
Oh, fantastic.
Song, Ishraq. They got a whole album that's slowly being released that's being uncovered. And before that, an excellent poem by Michaela Sahar at the Calliope X Capers fundraiser launch. And on the line, we have Sue Thompson.
Filmmaker. G'day, Sue. How are you?
I was running along a beach with a mustache.
That's exactly right. I just remind listeners, we're on Solidarity Breakfast. Yeah. So you are a fantastic filmmaker, and we've got you here because you've just released a film to cinemas called Careless. And I know that if our listeners are out there, they can go and watch it at Nova. I'm not sure where it's on at the moment in other places, but it's looking at the issue of aged care. And one of the things that's so amazing about you is that you make films that make really difficult issues accessible to the general viewer. That's true, isn't it? That was what you were aiming for.
Yeah, that's very kind of you. Thank you for having me. And yes, that's what I'm desperately trying to do in this world, is create films that are about, you know, issues relevant to us as, you know, people that live in Australia and what that means, and also make them entertaining.
Yeah, that's exactly
definitely
right.
What I set out to do.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I always think about myself, you know, as an audience. It's like, I'm concerned about the world. I want to, you know, I want to talk about the world. I want other people to think perhaps differently than they do. And if I make something about an issue, which I know most people roll their eyes and go, oh, who cares? It's just another boring documentary. My thing is, okay, no, because I do have a background in comedy. I started Work at the Last Laugh a million years ago and spent a lot of time there. And so most of the films I make have some sort of comic element in them, despite them often being quite serious issues.
Well, that's, of course, life, I'll have to say.
Maybe, yes.
And one of the things about this film is that, like you said, you're very much like a 3CR approach, because you start this investigation into the aged care sector in Australia by getting your mum on board.
Yeah, that was hard.
Yeah, I betcha.
It was really hard. And I have to sort of, full transparency, she died on Saturday. So very
close. Oh, Sue.
I know. I'm just going to share. That's the first time I've said that.
Oh, my God.
And I might get a bit emotional because it's bizarre that I've made this film about an issue that I've been dealing with, and suddenly 4 days before it's released, my mum dies, not unexpectedly. She had been in hospital for 3 weeks very sick, but...
And also she was 90.
She was 90, which is wonderful, because she's had, you know, my mum's had a myriad of health issues for the last 10 years. So, and I had to see the film on Thursday when it first opened, and I hadn't seen it for, you know, a few weeks. You see it a lot when it was happening and when it was on at MIFF. I was always watching it and trying to, you know, consider the work and think about it, and watching it the other day, and all I could see was mum, and I was like, wow, I'm so proud that I have made this film as a semi-testament to an incredibly difficult and complex woman, and yet she comes across, you know, what's nice is audiences really like her. My mum was, you know, she'd been alone for 50 years. She lived alone. She was a feminist. She was fiercely independent. She and I adored each other, excuse me, and clashed enormously, as often daughters do with mothers. And so making this and getting her in it, initially I was really nervous and thought, I cannot make a film with Margaret Thompson. Everyone will see, you know, that she could be a battle axe and I'll be embarrassed and blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, there were many times that she snapped at me that we have cut out a lot in the edit. You can see a couple of moments when we're clearly, you know, a little tense with each other, because that role of being a carer, excuse me, and a daughter is very sort of muddled by the end. And then the complexities of just dealing with a system that you think is about care. And obviously what careless is about is that care in the aged care sector, like most of our health systems in Australia, there's a profit motive behind them all. And it's all about making money. And our governments have just completely handed us over to corporate and big business and said, these people will look after you. And obviously, as we all know, we live in a capitalist society, and that means they've got to make money. So I find that sickening, even as I'm saying it to you now, still. It infuriates me that we live in a country that, you know, people benefit from the healthcare sector.
Well, it's actually cutting out community.
Yeah.
And the issues that you do in this film is really, the way you tell the story, you've got your mother as a thread. You've got other people who's obviously compatriots of yours, professional women who have got parents who are also equally feisty but also ageing. And what I find most interesting, of course, is that this has also happened to me, of course. My parents are both dead, but I have gone through this whole process as well. But I come from a very large family, and luckily various members of my family were either bossy or capable or whatever, you know what I mean? You could and the point I'm making is that it only happens to you once. It only happens to you once. So you go through this journey and you discover the inadequacies of a system that's been created for profit once. And what you're telling people out in the world with your film is, mark my words.
That's a really great way of putting it, Annie. I mean, it's like I hadn't even thought about that. And you're right, I've been through it and it's over as of last
Saturday. It's over, yeah.
Like, and you're absolutely right. That's phenomenal. But so what I did in Careless, I didn't think about what you're saying, and now I'm considering it as a person who's had that experience. It's like you want to do your best, and depending on the parents and their health, you know, I've been caring for my mother pretty much, you know, on and off full-time for 5 years. That's a lot of years of your life. And then before that, you know, I was doing a lot for the last 10. But you feel like you're in a system that's going to support you, and you feel very capable, but more and more you feel less capable and the system wears you down, even if you're, you know, quite capable of doing things or bossy, as you say, and all that. It is still a really complex system, and the loneliness that you can feel while you're caring for an older person is pretty full on, I reckon.
Yeah, I do too. Go on.
First, I'd like to say thanks for talking to us a bit about your mum. I feel like it's really nice to get to hear your reflections as part of kind of recounting the film. And I'm sorry for your loss.
And I want to say thank you for letting me say it. It's nice to do it on 3CR the first time. I'm not going to say it a lot, but, you know, today just felt like, you know what, I'm going to say it rather than pretend she's not dead. So, sorry, what's your question?
I was going to say, I think, you know, almost a little bit to Annie's point about the fact that this is something, is a reality that is coming for us all. I think something I've always found really confusing about the aged care issue, quote unquote, is that it's like people forget that all of us are going to be in that position one day. We're all going to get old. We're all going to need care and support. And I was wondering if your kind of process of putting together the film gave you any insight into how we've ended up in a situation where so many Australians end up in aged care or have family in aged care, but all of these issues have kind of fallen through the cracks.
Well, the film is all about that.
I mean, it's like, and I agree with what you're saying, that first part of your question about, you know, we all, there's a woman in the film called Sarah Holland Batt who says this great line about, none of us think we're going to get there. Me too, and I'm one of those people, we all think somehow we're going to avoid aged care. And to your thing, and that's the thing about getting old is a privilege, and we also need to remember that not everyone will get old. So it's a double-edged sword in the sense that we're lucky to age and we're lucky to get really old, but then, what are we going to do when we get there? Does that mean if my legs aren't working, like my mother, for example, or, you know, all the health issues that come with aging, I have to go into care? that's when, and now, okay, what I've learned from the film is like, oh, I have to think about that. I've avoided it. You know, I'm fit and healthy. It's not going to happen. Or, well, of course it's going to happen to me now. And going through making the film, I realised I do have to make plans. And in a way, Careless is a tool for, I want everybody to watch that film and consider what you personally want for yourself as you get old, because perhaps you can put things in place that can assist yourself, the family, community, governments to get there, because otherwise you just become a cog in a machine and you're just sucked into the vortex of this system mm-hmm. with no choices. And so for me, that's really independent that we take, it's really important so that we take back a little bit of our independence and make some decisions much earlier than when we're in our 70s, 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. Like now, we need to be... I would love Careless to go in schools, because I thought, how incredible if I could get young people who really respond quite well to the film thinking about, what do I want for my mum and dad, or how do I see my ageing in the world?
Yeah, and maybe to that point as well, how did you feel rewatching the movie? Like you briefly said, you watched it, you know, after after your mum had passed. Sort of like once you're in making all the movie, and that's kind of like a different brain, and then watching it, and as kind of you're like having a conversation with yourself, and maybe seeing your mum in a different light, not just as like your mum, but also as like a person speaking to you through a movie. I wondered how that felt and how your experience changed from making the movie to watching the movie.
Making the movie was hard, and my daughter, Lola, came on as co-producer. She's working in the film industry, and she worked as a buffer zone between mum and I, because we can clash quite a bit. And, you know, I would walk in and mum would go, oh, God, you know, you're here sort of thing. And Lola would come in behind me and she'd go, oh, hi, Lola. And so I had employed Lola not really even thinking about that. And to be brutally frank, I don't know if I could have made the film with my mother without her, because we do, you know, clash as mother and daughter. And so... And because I am a carer, it drives mum crazy, because I have to say, you know, well, you've got a doctor's appointment tomorrow that you asked me to book, you know, well, I don't want to go to it. And then Lola's there to sort of make everything easy. So when I was making the film, I was a filmmaker often, and I could feel myself separating the daughter thing, because I was like in my head thinking, well, I need this shot and I need you to say this and I want you to talk about this. And she wasn't very sort of pliable, but Lola would help with that. And so then watching it, and then I watched Dream Myth and didn't really think much, but watching it on Thursday, what you're saying is so true, and it was actually quite beautiful, because I saw my mum as my mum, and I can see little bits of me in there, but it's like she tried really hard. She does give, she is funny and feisty, and you know, she helped create me, and I'm indebted to her forever. And she was pretty amazing that she managed to live in this world. And, you know, she did lots of volunteer work, and she was a nurse, and she worked her whole life, and she put back into society. And now she's helped create this, you know, film. And at the end of the film, I do ask her, I say, why did you do this film, Mum? And it's actually in there. And it's a kind of a slightly twee thing, and not something I normally do in my films. But, you know, we talked about it in the edit suite quite a lot, the editor and my co-producer, Adam and Lola, about mum saying, I say, why did you do this film, mum? Or, you know, she said, because I wanted to help you. See, it makes my voice break. And it's like, oh. She said, I didn't ever help you with any of the others, and I wanted to help you with this one. Yeah. And I thought in my head two things. I thought, well, I never asked you to help the others because they weren't relevant to you. But... how beautiful is that? That she thought she was doing a thing to help me, and it's like her acknowledging me as a filmmaker and a daughter. And I thought, so that's, yeah, it's remarkable to have the film exist and her no longer be here. And I'm incredibly proud. And I think she says some really good things actually in it.
I do too.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing the movie, but I just like even just, as you were speaking there, it's kind of like this reclaiming the, I mean, I'm from Italy, so the traditional way of caring for the elderly is this intergenerational link. And as you were speaking, it's kind of like through this movie you were able to recapture this connection that's been lost through the privatization of aged care, but that you've included, you know, your daughter, and that all these generations are kind of talking to each other and learning from each other. So I think it's, I mean, apart from obviously the personal experience that you would have, I think it'll be imparted. It sounds like it will be imparted in the movie, and I very much look forward to it. So I thank you for making it in advance.
Yeah, and there is an Italian couple that you'll love, Luciano and Mario.
Yeah, there is.
So they talk a bit about the stuff you just said. And you're right. You're actually the second person that brought up the intergenerational thing, and I didn't really realise it, but you're right. You know, I have, it's my mum with her granddaughter as well, and it's, and you know, her grandchildren did care for her a lot, so I'm glad that that's come through a bit.
No, before, because we, you know, we could talk about this forever, but this is only yeah. one. This is only
I could.
Yeah, this is only one part of the film. Actually, the other part of the film, because you're a very clever filmmaker, you have inserted all the elements of the story of the privatisation and the bipartisan nature of this attack on our community our political masters and their economic slave drivers. You do it step by step. All of them are got their fingerprints on the destruction of the system. You also go into something that's very important, which is that it's important to have a nursing home system and respite system, because in the past, incredible levels of weight were put onto female members of families, and also elderly people become medically ill. They become ill and they need certain supports that can't be provided in the home. So, and you point out things that are devastating. During COVID, 60% of the deaths were in privatised nursing homes, and that Bupa is at this moment having a class action against it, which started in April in 2025. They own the most aged care places, and they have never been able to fulfil the care requirements set up by law.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, and I'm sorry, you beautifully surmised what we tried to do, which was to show the grimness and the bleakness out there, but that these are real people, and that Bupa, you know, it says in the film 76 of their homes.
Yeah, something like that,
During the Royal Commission too, they were one of the companies that kept coming up, and the failings in their nursing homes and the deaths. I mean, you're right. In fact, there wasn't a death in any of the publicly owned nursing homes. So the government-run nursing homes in Australia during COVID didn't have any deaths. They had a lot of illness, but it was everyone who died was in a private nursing home.
Isn't that just outrageous?
Yeah, and the government does nothing about it. This is what, you know, because somebody said to me, okay, well, what would you want? I said, okay, I understand we live in a capitalist society. I can understand this is not going to change overnight, but how about government work together with the system that they've put in place? Like, maybe it's a 50-50 partnership. None of this sort of handing the entire system over to private enterprise, and, you know, which is now becoming like massive corporations are basically owning the bulk of the homes in Australia. And it's like, how about you come back on board and do this together? If it's all about making money, which it is, at least there should be, you know, some sort of co-ownership between government. The fact that we privatise everything in this country is insane. And the healthcare system is, I find it's just abusive that they do this to us. And we vote them in.
I go further. I think the governments think that they're there. They've changed the message. They think that the governments are there for business, but they're actually there to represent us. They're not there to represent business, and they've got it wrong. And the other thing about it is that people have to claw this back, because in actual fact, they are responsible for the care of us, not the care
the
of business.
The education, the health, like that's the thing. That's what governments exist for. I don't get it. Yeah, it's infuriating, and I can see it's not going to happen overnight. I'm not an idiot, but I believe that if we are all more aware of how systems work, that we play into, that we buy into, that we are a part of, perhaps through talking, chatting at a community level, we can try and start, you know, resting back some, at least having a voice occasionally.
I forgot to say that one of the things that the government has finally got in a bipartisan and business has got is that elderly people have and their families now have to stump up exorbitant amount of money in a prepay before anybody even is allowed to go into a home. And that usually means that they have to sell their family home.
Yeah, if they've got one, Annie.
If
Beverly,
they've got one.
In the film, was a renter. She didn't own a home. Her husband died. She was on the pension. She realised that was not going to cover her rent. Like, you know, some people don't have a choice. And that's what, you know, in Careless, as you know, I don't go into aged care. In the end, I decided we know what aged care looks like. I'm not going to spend this film in aged care. So everyone in the film is trying to avoid going in. That's just like a little tiny subtle message. They don't want to go in. And I wanted to just talk about why don't you want to go in. You know why? Because we're not doing a good job. That's why.
Thanks
Those
for talking
places,
us.
That's terrifying.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, Sue. And
no worries.
And the film Careless is on at Nova. Is it? Where else is it out?
It's on a classic. It's on at Palace, like, you know, Pentridge, Ballwin, Brighton. There's a whole lot of them. You can look it up. But Palace Cinemas and Nova, in Melbourne.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you. See you. Thanks for having me.
Sue, Teardrops. Since we're getting a little bit sentimental, these guys love it. We're with you guys. This is a cover we do. Goes out to anyone who remembers it.
I'm is a rapacious expansion of privatisation, which is going to change the face of the city that we live in.
It's not share. It's not making the housing crisis go away. It's really about the big end of town. It's a shame job.
It's a transfer. It's a theft of public wealth, which is going to worsen the housing crisis.
The government is giving public land to private developers. Why would you do that? Why would you give all these assets over to the biggest bully in town?
We're looking down to a future that we don't know what's going to happen. Where are we going to get moved to? Dandenong or away from our communities and away from the services that we need?
This is a line in the sand for not only the public housing tenants, but for a Victorian society.
3CR, here to stay.
A weak solidarity, Bricky Teen listener, when as lovers of, as devotees of, the greatest little economic order of them all, what excitement that end of year time again, when we can celebrate all things profit and profit and profit, as the True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review announces its annual Capitalist of the Year Award. Well, it calls it Business Person of the Year, won a year ago so worthily, so wonderfully deserved by our filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina. Well, this year, number one is a bloke called Mike Durrell, real name, whom I must confess I'd never heard of till he won it, showing how ignorant I am. Mike left True Blue Aussie some years ago to run Macquarie Bank's US of the UN of the US of the world's infrastructure division, and the rest is history. His own global infrastructure behemoth, a private $225 million island off Florida, a New York mansion, that's his official residence, still finding time to skip back to True Blue Aussie a couple of times a year. But one criticism of the Capitalist Review, we would have to take issue with its headline. Timing is everything for infrastructure, and here's the take issue bit, for infrastructure, shark. Shark? Shameful. How dare they? Doubtless a warm, caring, loves all little fishies shark. But also awarded, and this warms the cockles of, a great friend and supporter of the week that was, yes, Woodside with Profits' very own Meg O'Neill before Profits. Meg, it tells us, has played an enduring role through the decades-long energy transition. Yes, Meg knows we can't rush these things. Investing in gas, gas, gas and oil, oil, oil all over the world to frank her commitment to the decades-long transition. It is clear, the Capitalist Review writes, that Colorado raised O'Neill before Profits is prepared to act on her convictions. Hear, hear. And as we know, she has plenty of those. What a wonderful capitalist world, a True Blue Aussie filthy rich resident in the US of, a US of filthy rich right here in True Blue Aussie. Oh, and the report admired her courage, which makes us ponder on how a few long-haired commie, greenie, wooden work in an iron environmentalists sitting in vehicles on her street could have so terrified her. Poor, courageous, frightened Meg. Well, her home is sacrosanct. These lawless protesters have no right to invade her space, unlike Megan the resource behemoths lawfully invading. No, no, that's too emotive. Their lawful right to utilise, exploit for the common good the terra nullius non-land, non-people's land and sacred sites and the environment generally. No comparison. On which we'd think that after 237 years of playing host to the boat people, the terra nullius non-land non-people would learn their place in our world. Well, more non-place, although the Centre for Racial Profiling feels they do know their place, being searched, questioned, suspected, harassed, abused by the keeping us all safe, a constabulary for clearly suspicious behaviour like existing. How can non-people exist? But in fairness, our friendly police don't just protect us from terra nullius non-land non-people. They also search, question, suspect, harass and abuse African, Pacific Island and Middle Eastern communities, also suspected of existing. So how can they be accused of racial profiling? like the Northern Troubler Aussie government, which does so much for terra nullius non-land non-people, like jail 10-year-olds, provide non-land non-people with pepper spray, and increase the rents on dilapidated housing in remote communities by up to 200%. And talk about the law and the non-people being irrational. They took it to court, which ruled the increase illegal. Worse, the government, which does so much for these non-people, has to consult them. It's getting out of hand. Now, on housing, in the, gee, we'd never have thought of that department, proof that Treasury officials are worth every cent of whatever they're worth. After deep research, they've fingered the solution to the so-called housing crisis. Supply is the key, they analysed. Gee, Treasury, we'd never have thought of that. Although being able to afford the supplied could also play a bit of a role in the solution, which could be assisted by Treasury convincing governments they could play a key role in solving the affordability problem by building and owning the increased supply. Thought quite excitedly there may have been a step in that direction a couple of days ago. Mentioned a couple of weeks ago that the speaker from that commie front, the True Blue Aussie Institute, told the huge meeting opposing demolishing and privatising perfectly good public housing, said the federal government does still build public housing. It builds housing for True Blue Aussie and US OB trained killers. So the excitement, step in. Headline leapt out at me. Prime defence land sites targeted to boost housing and fire budget. Wasn't sure what we needed a budget for fire, just buy a box of matches, but misread it. No, they don't plan to use all that trained killer public housing for non-trained killer public housing, increasing the non-trained killer supply. They plan to flog trained killer sites in prime real estate locations, raising billions to fire up, that's where the fire bit came in, fire up the train killer budget stretched by the onomatopoeic Forker's demands. Oh dear, did I get it wrong? And the publicly owned land and train killer housing will free up land for high density housing, allowing developers to make a killing, but not doing a hell of a lot for that affordability problem. The great resource behemoths, it seems, are also facing an affordability problem as they are forced reluctantly to slash spending on non-polluting so they can afford polluting. In that capitalist review hagiography of Meg O'Neill before profits, for instance, it says her dragging her feet on decarbonisation efforts has been welcomed by investors, investing on carbonisation for good reason, so they can transition from carbonisation, and great friend of the non-land non-people, Rio Tinto the Profits, announced Thursday it will cut decarbonisation spending by $6 billion to cut costs. While the big Aussie of which we are so proud, BHP, for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, also announced it was postponing plans to cut pollution. See, when it comes to Mother Earth or investors' profits, it's a no-brainer. One of the few honest things, perhaps the only honest thing, US of big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor has done, is call the department for what it is. The Department of War, of trained killing, of being offensive. And apart from Donald himself, it's hard to think of anyone more offensive than his Secretary of War, of trained killing, of being offensive. His arch-conservative, shock jockery, impeccable qualifications, Pete Hegg, kill 'em all. Although Pete explained survivors of the US OB bombing yet another Venezuelan fishing boat was down to the fog of war. The fog mostly between Pete's ears. And let slip the dogs of war, that this foul deed shall smell above the earth with carrion men groaning for burial. Foul deed indeed. But war, Pete? What war? Oh, the war for Venezuela's rich resources and Secretary for U.S. of World State Rubio's desire to liberate evil Cuba. Expat True Blue Aussie Silk Jeffrey Robertson, asked whether murdering the survivors was a war crime, said, yes, but so was bombing the boat in the first place. Although Donald and Pete and senior US of trained killers assure us the mass murder of Fisher people is legal, despite Pete also bemoaning the rules of trained killing are a barrier to US of trained killers doing their job as they stroke he'd like. Like slaughter, destruction and genocide aren't enough? But then it's all justified because Donald so loathes drugs destroying the US of. Although what he's got against fish, we've got no idea. So there must have been very, very extenuating circumstances for pardoning former Honduran corrupt extreme conservative Supremo Hernandez out, who had been sentenced to 45 years for smuggling several hundred K of cocaine into the US of. Very, very extenuating circumstances. Or perhaps Donald doesn't realise cocaine is a drug. Wonder what he thought they were all snorting at his very, very close friend, brackets former, Jeffrey Epsleaser's orgies. And in an orgy of profits, companies owned by Donald's scion, Donald Jr., have picked up at least $735 million, that's about $1 billion True Blue Aussie, in Pete's Department of Train Killing contracts, prompting most unfairly an ethics group to proffer, big supremos are expected to avoid even the appearance that they are using their office to financially benefit themselves or their family. How ignorant. A split infinitive. Oh, and how dare suggest Donald Wood, fake news yet again. That US OB report into the Focus 38 mil a day to train kill has apparently concluded it's in the US OB's train killer interests, reducing our Minister for Train Killing and being offensive Richard Malls the bad guys, he of the giant mind, to a bundle of trembling excitement. Well, of course, True Blue Aussie subsidising the US OB Merchants of Death war machine with billions of our hard-earned is in the US OB's interests. Pity it sure as hell is not in True Blue Aussie's interests. Although Richard of the Giant Mind keeps telling us the socialists also conducted a report when first elected, when we thought they couldn't bow fast enough, low enough, servilely enough at the altar of our father country. Wonder when we'll see this mysterious report. Oh, and finally, if women want to work at Amazon poverty wages, want? Who'd want to? If it's the only job they can get, you can get. Make sure your contraception works. Although poor Amazon poverty, last month the New Jersey attorney claimed this proud, caring employer discriminated against pregnant women. And just this week, right here in True Blue Aussie, in the biased Fair Work True Blue Aussie No Longer Work Choices Just Looks Like It con mission, a warehouse worker sacked, or sorry, sadly happened to be let go, after advising she was pregnant, was reinstated and awarded $15,000. $15,000. Imagine the dent that'll make in Amazon poverty wages coffers. The company argued it had merely put her shifts on hold. Permanently on hold. As former big supremo Malcolm Wage Freezer said, life wasn't meant to be easy for caring employers. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. And on the line we have Colm from Earthworker and Singing Blackbird Studios. How are you this morning?
Very good. Hello to everybody in the studio.
G'day.
Hi. How are you going?
Very good.
You've come to talk to us about a lot of things, but you've been real busy, and you will be busy in the coming year with Singing Blackbird Studios. We first crossed paths at the Gramsci night that you spoke very heterodoxly at.
To use your words.
No, I'm sorry.
And you're still speaking to me.
Yeah. But also you've got an amazing program. Maybe we could spend a minute about talking about how you're thinking strategically program next year. aims to touch on some of the most important lineages of revolutionary thought and maybe inspire revolution in Australia, question mark, like your last session suggests.
Yeah, well, I mean, the sort of precursor to it all is, I think, in Australia, and in other parts of the world as well, but Australia specifically, the left is very much caught in what I call a tactical hell. They don't really look up. They're caught in reacting to the 24-hour news cycle, and they can't really respond, and they don't really think strategically. And because of the, you know, four decades of neoliberalism, we've sort of dug ourselves into a massive hole. Add on top of that, not only that internalised defeat, the breakup of those working-class communities and industries over the last four decades, and also identity politics, sort of cancel culture, we've got quite a toxic little brew going on.
And you're devising almost an antidote. Well, I mean, you're just carrying on a legacy of work of...
So what we're trying to do is how do you create a culture? It's not the basic premise is not, oh, Colm knows and he's some wise old guru. No, the question is, how do we create a culture? How do we consciously dig ourselves out of this hole? How do we learn to respond? How do we learn to use our imagination in ways we haven't before? Because that's a big part of what's going on. The imaginary is really, really still stultified or dead, if you want to be blunt. And so how do we actually dig ourselves out of this hole? So it's not that I have the answers, but it's trying to ask the questions or create a container to ask the questions to sort of deepen that process, to engage historically. Because what I see in the left as well is people are very good at critique. You say a word and they can critique it to the eyeball. But can they bring in the history that gives the context of where that critique comes from? And because when you bring those things together, then you're starting to create new possibilities. But we're so good at critiquing and, you know, looking internally and finding imperfections in each other that we just destroy so much stuff. We don't have a vision. We're not engaging outwardly with ordinary people everywhere. We're really sort of looking internally. So it's how do you create a counter to this? Now, I don't think I have the answer to it, but it's about trying to ask those questions and pushing and probing people and being heterodox, like you said, to actually, you know, see what possibilities emerge.
Yeah, with this introduction to thinking strategically, I noticed that it goes over 8 weeks, and what I've noticed is that people learn historical context, or they listen to what people have said in the past, and it's got this eerie feeling of being contemporary and modern. It's like nothing has changed. So you actually go and you look into what Mao Zedong actually was on about.
Yes, and his relationship to Sun Tzu, and the role of the Confucian and Taoist thinking, even though he rejects it. But when that engaged, for example, Mao Zedong and the relation of the People's War, people talk about decolonization now as though it started 5 years ago. And the other thing is that so many people talk about it, I hear them talk about it, and they think it's like, I'm individually committed to decolonization. Decolonization in the Australian context is about 15 to 20 million people being involved. It's not just three people in the northern suburbs of Melbourne or 20, whatever. It's like, we haven't got the imagination. And then how did Mao...
But it's not just that. I reckon it's people aren't prepared to fight to win.
Well, that's part of it, because they've never tasted that dish. They don't know what... They forgot what it tastes like. And it used to be the trade unions with their ability to strike is where a lot of people would train in this, but that's been sort of curtailed. So where do we actually learn these abilities and build these skills and build these ways of, you know, understanding the power, being able to relate to people, being able to... Because, you know, if you just meet ordinary people and all you're doing is going, you're not politically correct, you don't use the right pronouns, you don't use the right words, we're going nowhere. People can be won over. We don't need to just dismiss people because, let's say, they're not politically correct. I mean, it's the truth, you know, none of us are. And we're all compromised and contradictory beings.
And it's a process, and this is part of the thing that's been lost, is the process of and thinking that we're all in it together, and that the betterment of everyone is in everyone's best interests. But I'm also interested in this the other aspect that you were talking about briefly at the Gramsci event, and we spoke about it at your event that you had at Black Spark a couple of weeks ago, about this the mythologies that need to be created here or that are available to us, that are alternatives to sort of patching in, you know, maybe people don't want to claim like a Marxist tradition, but, you know, you could claim like a Kellyist tradition as a kind of new mythology to build a revolutionary movement for the people here?
Well, that's part of the imagination, and also it's very much about storytelling in place. I think that what happens in Australia is a lot. We look to Britain and America, especially, for our imaginations, and that's part of the poverty. The Labor Party does, the Liberal Party, and so do most of the left. But how do we actually root our transformative communities in this place and the stories of this place? And of course I'm referring to Indigenous stories, Indigenous dreaming stories, and becoming kin to this place rather than being, we use these words, settler, colonizer, et cetera, migrant to this place. How do we actually start to become part of this place and start speaking like the Latin Americans have done in their creation of their Latin American Marxisms, where they actually have this massive dialogue with Indigenous communities, and they've been doing it for 500 years. And well, it's like, and they have all this, whether it's Zapatistas or whether it's the communities in Bolivia or Ecuador or Brazil, there's this massive dialogue going on, and the mythologies are central to that. That's part of the imaginary, re-instigating that imaginary possibility.
It's interesting you should say that, because I'm not sure many people have actually read the Gerildery letter, if you're going to talk about Ned Kelly. And actually, that's a pretty mind-blowing letter, I'll have to say. Have you read it?
It certainly is. Yeah. But then there's also Ned Kelly's Indigenous people up in Wave Hill in Northern Territory have actually brought him into a dreaming story.
Ah, right.
So it's like, well, this is the sort of stuff that, you know, because part of the, if any sort of political movement is going to really work, is you've got to out-imagine your opponent. Because a lot of what people are trying to do, they already have the textbook, you know, developed in the School of the Americas or wherever, to destroy, or COINTELPRO or Special Branch or whatever you want to call it, MI6. But we need to create movements that they actually don't actually understand the imaginary of what we're doing. And that's good, because it gives us time and space. That's the strategy, creating time and space to respond rather than react, and creating new possibilities, new way of engaging.
It's actually funny you should say that, because with the, the movement, Wall Street, you know, anti-Wall Street movement.
Occupy.
One of the things that the coppers really found really difficult, because it was a methodology that was employed for a while here, where they couldn't find anybody to speak to. They decided, the demonstrators decided that they wouldn't have a central person contact point for the coppers, and the coppers just went out of their brains.
Yes.
But I like this idea of this. Well, I mean, it is, Diane de Prima talks about the battle for the imagination, and I just can't help but think that that's the most important part, and that's also our patrimony as the left is the imagination. The right wingers don't have an imagination, and I think we've just been misled into playing their game or trying to beat them at their own, which we can't. But we can win our own game, and I think maybe just if you could tell the listeners a bit more about what you're offering at the strategic thinking seminar series, what really, yeah, like people will get.
Well, what it's trying to do is it's two things, and one of them is helping people to engage, and lots of people have critique, but bring that into the history question, but also into a much bigger question of how do we reimagine what's possible and who we are and what we're doing. And I suspect also we're partly, it's not just a question of, you know, let's say the proletariat versus the bourgeoisie in that sort of old leftist paradigm, but we're in all these dynamics of collapse, whether it's about US empires and the wars that creates and the ecological, we need to reimagine what the left can mean and find the opportunities and possibilities as things get more crazy and out of control. We need to be showing what's possible there and actually be very grounded and our stories coming out of the earth. So we start with the whole thing of Mao Zedong, because that actually influenced the Vietnamese struggle very heavily. And people don't know this. They talk about decolonization, and they don't know how the Vietnamese defeated the American Empire. And that's just crucial. If you don't know that, it's like, what are you talking about decolonization for if you don't actually know how the Vietnamese did that? And then looking at the Panthers, they weren't successful, but I think part of their weakness was they knew they were political theater, but then they slipped into this question of the armed struggle, and they started to believe they could destroy the American state from within. And so this was part of a strategic sort of failure. And then we look at Gramsci, and especially his in Italy, and then his relationship to José María Tagui, and he's the guy that actually indigenized, if you will, that notion of popular national alliance, which is what Gramsci's response to the Southern Question, or the, you know, the very large peasantry in the south of Italy, and the reimagining of revolution that he did, and then how that influenced Latin American revolutions. And we do 2 or 3 weeks of that. So both the People's War coming out of Maoism and how it led into the Vietnamese, and then the whole thing of the rise of the Latin American Marxisms, are trying to create imaginary spaces. I don't think we can redo these things. We need to create things that are based in Australia and how we do things. In a very dry continent, in a very strong Indigenous place, with very deep stories and storytelling traditions, this is what we need to do. Have that encounter with Indigenous people and the land, and from that, our revolutionary possibilities emerge. Because we're always looking to Europe and other places, or but we're not actually basing our politics here. And this is what we need to do, because that's when it becomes real.
Well, I'll have to say that it runs from the 25th of February and runs to the 22nd of April, and people need to save their money because it's a commitment. It's not just a commitment of time. There's a bit of commitment of money because it's $150 for unwaged, $200 for underemployed, $250 waged, and $300 for supporters. And this is for Singing Blackbird. More power to your arm, Colm. That's all I can say.
and that's what it is. We're trying to create a culture. And it's not that we have the answers. And maybe some of it goes into the trade union movement. I'm from Earthworker, so we're doing work as co-ops, and we're thinking that's a way we can work forward. But, let a thousand flowers bloom. But wherever you bring that culture to it, hopefully we can start some sort of process. Because the far right is in total ascendancy, and the left is fighting way below its weight.
That's right.
And we really need to be bringing people in, not just forcing people away because of our silliness around always being internally looking for perfection, not being able to hold contradictions, not being able to love each other, because we're all messed. We're all a mess. So this idea that we need perfection, we've got to get rid of that.
Well, there's a world to be won. There's a world to be won, I'll have to say. And they can find out about this by going online. It's Humanitex, but it's Introduction to Thinking Strategically. You can do the search.
And we'll Blackbird Enterprises. That's the crew. That's a storytelling workers co-op.
Yeah,
and we do both animist stuff and also left stuff as well.
Yeah, an 8-week course, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. at the new International Bookshop, starting next year.
And we'll have to have you back on for all the other stuff, because I'm interested to pick your brain about the neo-Gaelic mythologizing that you've been doing as well.
Yeah. That's part of it too.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for taking your time this morning, and we look forward to having you back maybe in the new year.
Great, thanks a lot.
Thanks, mate.
See ya.
And we're coming up to the end of our program. We just thought maybe just to touch base on a couple of events that are happening. Tonight you can go see Rodrigo Acuna's movie, who we interviewed last week or a while back?
No, two weeks ago.
Yeah, a couple
your
weeks ago.
Your short-term memory is gone.
I think it might have even been a month ago, to be honest.
Yeah. Venezuela, The Cost of Challenging an Empire.
And it's at the Wildflower Picture House and Bar in Fitzroy.
That's just across from Peter Monti's, really. Just catch the number 11 tram, and it's a little film house in that area. Yeah.
And Sunday, tomorrow, there's the Palestine rally. The monthly rally is happening tomorrow at the State Library at midday. Make sure you go. As we heard from Nora Barris-Friedman, but as many people know from reading any reputable publication like Dropsite News or other, that the war on Palestine is ongoing, and it just goes...
And it's a disgrace.
...under silence of the ceasefire, but we know that over 590 ceasefire violations have occurred, and over 300 people have been killed and 900 injured in the time the so-called ceasefire has been called. So there is no better time now to get involved and organise more. Apart from that, I don't know if you guys have anything else. Otherwise, we'll leave it there for the week, and we'll see everyone next week.
And what are we going out with?
We're going out with a live version of King Stingray. Get me out of here.
Oh, great.
Swan, I think you might know this song. This one, Get Me Out of the City.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.